Earlier this year, law enforcement raided a boarding school in Keokuk, known as the Midwest Academy. One plaintiff attorney now says the abuse was like something out of Oliver Twist. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I talk with Des Moines Register investigative reporter Lee Rood to get an update on what kind of alleged abuse went on at the Tough Love School for Troubled Youth, as well as the investigations and the legal action currently underway. Before that, historian, writer, and lecturer Michael Lewick Trams recounts his recent time living and working in Germany as European countries try to cope with a flood of refugees. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. More than 1 million migrants and refugees crossed into Europe last year in 2015. The influx has sparked a crisis as European countries have struggled to cope with the human flood. It's also creating division in the EU over how best to deal with resettling people. Iowa native Michael Lewick Trams spends part of the year in the German city of Dresden teaching and writing. Last spring and summer, Lewick Trams was living in Europe and watched as more and more refugees fleeing war, fleeing poverty, also fleeing ecological disaster arrived in Europe. He also watched to see how his German neighbors, his students, his friends and relatives reacted to those newcomers. Lewick Trams recently returned to Iowa to accompany a mobile Iowa history exhibit through Humanities Iowa. And for this mobile tour, he gives presentations on many different topics, including his observations of the immigrant challenge in Europe. He joins me now, Michael Lewick Trams. Welcome to our program.
Thanks so much, Ben.
Share with us, first of all, some of your observations about the refugee crisis from that vantage point you had last year living and working in Dresden, Germany.
Right. Some of the responses of my neighbors, my students, my friends, and others would be just normal human responses. Oh, what do you do with these new people who don't speak your language very well and who live very differently than you do? But also some of the responses were very German. One of the things that I discovered coming back last fall to do last fall's bus tour was that the American media was not saying exactly the same things that the German media was saying about the 1.5 million refugees, or as some people call some of them, migrants. Most Americans don't know, for example, that these refugees are not allowed to go anywhere they want to in the country. They're just as the same with me or with any German or any other person who's a resident of Germany. All these people have to be registered with the police. It's the same in Britain. It's the same in France, all across Europe. And America's an exception, not the rule, that every resident of a country has to be registered with the police. If these refugees aren't registered, they don't get housing allowances. They don't get access to food support or maybe for children's clothing support. They wouldn't get the subsidized German lessons, or some people even give free lessons. Volunteers are offering free German lessons. So if the refugees aren't registered, they don't get any help. Mm-hmm. The other thing is why they willingly go where they're sent is that the people are distributed all across the country to villages, to towns, to big cities. And so the German government tries to spread the integration process across the whole nation. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a country like the United States or Australia, newcomers would arrive and basically be on their own and could go wherever they wanted to go and do whatever they wanted to do. That doesn't happen right now in Germany. That's not the situation.
So as we think of the Germans as being very structured, systematic people, it's true here in finding out how to resettle these people that it's very structured and systematic.
Yes, and one of the things I tell my audiences when we're on the bus tour, which starts on Thursday, is that the Germans have lots of experience. At the end of World War II, there were between 10 and 12 million Germanic refugees who had come to what we knew as post-war Germany from what had then been Germany but now is Poland, in Danzig, now Gdansk. They came from Breslau, which is now Wrocław in Poland. They came from what we call Transylvania and Romania. So lots of ethnic Germans who were living already then either outside the German realm or what's now Poland or other areas carved off post-war Germany. And so in 1945, as you looked at the ruins of what had been pre-war Germany, there were up to 20 million refugees, displaced people, returned Jews who had gotten out of the camps and were not yet in Israel or somewhere else. So the Germans had to learn very quickly then you know, 50, 60, going on 70 years ago, how to deal with millions of people without jobs, without resources, without a home.
I wonder if that refugee, that historical refugee experience in World War II, and if that colors this current one in terms of, I know there are people in Germany, Germans who are very old now but lived through World War II. Does that color the conversations that you had with your German neighbors and students, friends?
It certainly does. The city where I spend part of each year is Dresden, in the former East, what we called Communist Germany or Eastern Germany. And ironically, the fewest non-Germans per capita are in the former East. The most non-Germans are in the former West. And yet the biggest problems, the biggest xenophobic attacks or resistance to bringing newcomers is in the East. At the same time, at the end of the war, every fourth person in what became the German Democratic Republic, the East German regime, was in transit themselves, had fled East Prussia or Pomerania or Silesia. So up to a quarter of the people in Eastern Germany know the refugee experience because they've lived it.
I wonder, as the refugees continue to come in 2015 during your time there, did attitudes change, at least according to media reports here we were getting of Europe, that Germany for sure under Angela Merkel was initially very, very welcome, and then a while back there was the incident during the carnival period in Cologne specifically. Did that incident and also other just the ongoing refugees and the burden this puts on societies, did that harden attitudes? Could you observe that?
Sure. Well, certainly the attitude on the streets has evolved, has shifted. At first there was shock, not in the sense of having had a car wreck, but rather, oh, this is something new and it's big and it's happening quickly. So there was a kind of shock. That shock began to shift as people realized these newcomers are among us and they need to have, meals and a bed, and they need to have clothes, and their children have to go to school. So the Germans went into sort of the practical mode. How do we integrate these people? Just the first part, how do we get them housed? How do we get them that they've got three meals a day? So this became really, rather than just shock, it became a pragmatic point of view. These people are here. How do we cope with this? As time has passed, you know, once the people's emergency needs were taken care of, then, of course, there's arisen this whole discussion culture in Germany. How do we go forward? I should note, by the way, when we say that at the end of World War II there were all these Germanic refugees living in what we knew as post-war Germany, almost no Americans realize that in the German Constitution it is written that Germany has an obligation to take refugees from war-torn countries. So Germany has legally an obligation to take refugees from countries where there are bombs falling. In the past, that was former Yugoslavia. It's been other countries. That's an important clause that, you know, Germany legally is obligated. So that changes the public discussion. That's not so much of an accusation game because Germany must take some of these people, but rather a coping question. How do we cope with this? And people have different opinions.
Mm-hmm. And do you see most people in agreement with that taking of refugees, or do you hear some, especially as time went on, that who said, you know, this is really getting to be quite a burden on our society, we need to change this policy?
I've heard no one express doubt in this part of the in this clause in the German Constitution. I've not heard literally someone say, oh, we need to change that. That's not happened, and there are reasons why that probably won't happen very quickly. What has happened is people said, you know, not only is this, you keep using the word burden, it's certainly a big task, but also there's the talk of this as an opportunity. Angela Merkel, who isn't Mother Teresa, by the way, she's very pragmatic, she knows the facts that Germany's population is declining, as is almost every country in Europe, other than perhaps hyper-Catholic Poland, but all the Western European countries, all of them, and all of our old allies, they're having fewer babies, people are dying faster than people are being born, and they literally, in the next 5, 10, 15, certainly 20 years, they will have too few people to occupy the jobs that are now being occupied by somebody. And so Angela Merkel keeps talking about, das ist unsere Chance, which means that's our chance, it's our opportunity, and she's right. Helmut Kohl, her predecessor, and the politician who cultivated her, he called her das Mädchen, my girl, my maiden. He once said that Germany is not an immigration country. And actually, historically, he was wrong, and he should have known he was a historian. In 1690, a third of Berlin was non-German. In 1690, about 30,000 of the then about 90,000 people spoke French as a first language. All the Huguenots had fled Catholic Protestant struggling France, and the Hohenzollern welcomed them because they brought new skills. They brought labor force. They went outside Berlin and dried the swamps, and they won new farmland that way. So the Germans know very well that new people do constitute new responsibilities, as you say, some burden. But long term, especially the younger people, and yes, the young males, those are also potential streetcar drivers, their dental assistants, people to work in the old folks' home, wiping granny's backside. So they're not lost on that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one other thing. Yeah, one other thing that's really crucial here is that there's been these horrific attacks in Brussels, and before that, at least twice in Paris, with the problem of Muslim terrorists. What's interesting is we have yet to date, and God willing it won't happen, but to date we've had none of those replicated in Vienna or in Munich or in Cologne or Berlin or any of the other Germanic cities. And why is that? The French have had a problem for decades already integrating people from the Maghreb, so Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, predominantly Muslim immigrants. You could say a few perhaps were fleeing something, but certainly immigrants, and many of them even spoke French. So France has been struggling for decades, and these newcomers formed de facto enclaves around every major French city, Paris, Marseille, Lyon. They all have these high-rise rings around them of non-French-born nationals. Well, these attacks are happening largely at the hands of young men who grew up in those countries. We know that the attackers last week in Brussels had indeed grown up in Belgium. They were Belgian nationals. Germany has yet to have that. You mentioned the unfortunate situation in Cologne on New Year's Eve. It was also in Hamburg. There were a few other places where there were these encounters between, let's say, migrant men and young German women. The Syrians that I know, I work with numerous refugees in Germany, they were all relieved that those young men tended to be from the Maghreb. It doesn't make the situation any better, but what it says is, you know, those are a different kind of newcomer. The Syrians say to me, God forbid that any of these things should happen at Syrian refugee hands, because we will all pay for that.
Let me remind those who may have just joined us, I'm speaking this half hour with Iowa native Michael Lewick Trams. He spends part of his year in Germany, in the city of Dresden, teaching and writing. He's sharing some of his observations now that he's back in the United States with his bus mobile museum, and talking about some of the things that he experienced and while witnessing the refugee crisis in Europe last year. I wonder, is there a particular moment, Michael, on the human side of this experience or crisis, a moment that you experienced in encountering refugees or the interaction between Germans and refugees that really brought home to you the reality of this, the human side of this crisis?
Yes, indeed. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Erfurt attending a conference, and I was walking down the street with two young Syrian refugees, young men. They were in their early 20s. One studying architecture, the other had been studying design. And as we walked through the dark streets of Erfurt, I asked them, so are you here alone? They both were, without their families. I said, well, do your families know where you are and that you're okay? And they both said, well, our mothers, one was in Damascus, the other was in Beirut, so a refugee living in Lebanon. And I asked, well, and your fathers? And the architectural student said, I was at the university studying. My mother was at work. My father was at home. A bomb fell and it killed him. So, I mean, when you're standing next to one of these people and they inform you, no, my father doesn't know where I am because he's dead under a bomb, you know, what do you say to that?
Right. And this is a reality that for most of us is unimaginable and horrific.
Well, we know, we've seen the TV footage of the refugees trying to get across the river in Macedonia the last couple of weeks ago, trying to get around the barbed wire, desperate to walk all the way to Germany. Some of the people are being pushed in wheelchairs, young men of maybe 30 or so. They have no legs. I've seen pictures of children, of girls missing a foot or an arm. The people literally are on the ground as bombs fall. And I guess if a bomb fell in our house, we'd not want to stay in that spot any longer either.
So what is it like returning to the United States where we're relatively safe and don't have those sorts of encounters, to come back to a country where we can have a real political struggle over accepting a few thousand Syrian refugees.
One of the biggest struggles for me personally is, from my point of view, I come from academia, I teach, I write, I lecture. I'm going to be doing that for the next 6 weeks in Iowa and then again in the fall. There is, in my point of view, a big disconnect between what's going on the ground in Europe and people's perspective of those events here. Part of it is the media. I think the media's done a very miserable job talking about the situation as it really is. In the olden days, newspapers, which have now mostly disappeared, actually had foreign correspondents living in those countries reporting on them. William Shirer was paid by the Chicago Tribune to live in Nazi Germany with his Austrian wife. People spoke the language. And when I came last fall to do the Busium tour, we're on the second of three of the series, I was shocked that, you know, I would hear reports from reporters standing in Berlin or somewhere with a microphone, and yet I had to wonder, do they even know the situation? Do they even speak German? Again, people missing fundamental things, and often the interpretation's wrong. What's interesting, when I arrived last fall, I only heard the word migrants being used. At that time in Germany, only the word refugee was being used. There's a big difference between a migrant who goes to something is being attracted, is being pulled to a new situation, to a refugee who's running away from something, who's being expelled. So there's this push-pull difference, and the word each makes a big difference.
You are the director of TRACE's Center for History and Culture that's supported by Humanities Iowa, also supported by other organizations, AARP, the Iowa Genealogical Society, local historical societies, Iowa Quakers, and Scattergood School. You're starting your spring showings of your newest bus museum exhibit. It's called At Home in the Heartland, Forgotten Stories of How Iowans Got to Be Us. This is a wonderful theme. And one of the questions that you address in your presentations is this interesting question of how Iowa Quaker farmers and college kids brought some 185 refugees from Nazi-occupied Europe to the American heartland, to Iowa, and how did they offer them a new life here?
I'm glad that you're actualizing a historical case study. Indeed, young Iowa Quaker kids, farm kids, small-town kids, met in the summer of 1938 at the Methodist camp in Clear Lake, and they talked in the summer of 38, oh, this Hitler character, he's doing horrible things to the Jews and to others. We should do something. And the young Quakers, they did something different from their neighbors. Instead of just saying we should do something, they said we will do something, and they made a plan. They had a closed boarding school near West Branch, Scattergood School, that had closed in 31 because of the Great Depression. And they said, you know, we could take this building and bring the people Hitler doesn't want, we could bring them to Iowa. Now, we have to remember this was before freeways, before jet engines. The idea is absurd. You know, it's the most ridiculous idea plausible that a bunch of Iowa farmers and, you know, Quaker small-town business people, that they'd bring people fleeing the Nazis to the middle of the cornfields, mm-hmm. but they did it. And yes, you could say, well, 185 is just a drop in the bucket, but it's a lot more than what was being saved down the road. Mm-hmm. So this is an applicable template for us if we mm-hmm. want it to be.
Does that have ripples on into this time? I mean, I'm wondering about those refugees. What, for instance, has become of them who came to the U.S., to Iowa?
Oh, yes. Some of your listeners will listen to David Wessels. He used to work for the, I think it was Wall Street Journal. Now he works for NPR often, talking about the economics. His mother and his grandparents were at Scattergood School. So next time you hear the name David Wessels, his family were saved in part by Iowa Quakers. So, yes, there really are literally those ripples today. They affect us, and we don't even know it.
Michael Lewick Tram's with us for another couple, 2 or 3 minutes. Fascinating questions that you look at in your Busium exhibit.
Busium.
Yeah. I'm still getting used to that. The Busium exhibit. Another one that you look at that has to do with World War II, something that Iowans or Americans know little about, if at all, is so many hundreds of thousands of German POWs were here in the United States during World War II. In fact, my father tells stories of that, serving them communion in southern Minnesota. But here in Iowa, we had 20,000 German POWs here.
Yes. In fact, the German POWs in southern Minnesota, in all likelihood, came through the Algona base camp. There were 10 branch camps around Iowa, places like Charles City, Waverly, Muscatine, Clinton, St- Storm Lake and other places, and there were 20 branch camps in Minnesota. So if your father saw them in the chapel, he was probably talking to men who...
He was an altar boy. He actually went to the camps with the priest and helped serve communion.
Yeah, that would be to the Algona system. Mm-hmm. There were 380,000 German soldiers that we and the British captured in North Africa, southern Italy, or later in France up to Normandy, and we brought them to the United States. There were another 50,000 Italian POWs that we or the Brits captured and brought to the United States, and there were 6,000 to 8,000 Japanese POWs, a great majority of whom ended up in Clarinda, Iowa, in the camp that had been full of Germans. They were later sent out to Algona, and the Japanese were brought. So, you know, these seemingly far away ancient historical events have direct connections to us. The most American POWs in the Third Reich in Nazi German hands came from Iowa per capita because of a freak capture in North Africa of thousands of Iowa 34th Division boys. That's why in southern Iowa there's the 34th Division Highway, the Red Bull Highway.
Mm-hmm.
Those men served the longest uninterrupted stint of service in World War II in Europe, and the most per capita of Americans captured and kept by the Germans. All these are stories that we've forgotten. You know, Iowa has a noble and colorful past, and unfortunately, most of us moderns, we know very few of those stories, really. We think we know the state, but if you dig deeper, the past is even more inspiring and rich than you'd think at first sight.
In the remaining minute, I have to throw in this experience that I had in my first encounter in Germany. Speaking German, and a grocery shopkeeper, noticing my American accent, asked me about my background and then beamed as he told me that he was, in fact, a German POW who had been brought to the United States. I asked him about that experience, and he talked about it like it was Disneyland, like it was the best thing that ever happened to him, being pulled out of this horrible war, brought to, I think he was brought to Texas, but just so grateful not to be in war, and so grateful for the respect he was shown as a POW.
Indeed, our organization Traces interviewed over 50 former German POWs, most of whom are now dead. We also interviewed 50 Midwest POWs who have been in their hands over there in the Third Reich, and the German POWs said, with few exceptions, that they were so grateful to get away from the bombs and the guns and the madness, and they found it a big adventure. You know, they loved America, with very few exceptions. They went back to Germany as friends of allies of ours. We could learn from that.
Okay, Michael Lewick-Trams, tell us what you're launching here with your Basium and how people can find out more in closing.
Sure. If people go to our website, www.roots, like saying under the ground, under tree, roots.traces.org, they can click on the box on the right. It says Spring 2016 Basium Tour. Our Basium will be in all the counties along I-80 and south to the Missouri border. We're spreading that trip over 6 or 7 weeks, all of April and up to May 22nd. We'll be all through the southern counties. And we're looking forward to people to come to our programs. Almost every day we're somewhere to be found, giving one of different themes.
Fascinating conversation about some things that we don't often talk about. Thank you, Michael Lewick-Trams. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And after a short break, we'll come back and get an update on a boarding school in Keokuk known as the Midwest Academy. It was raided by law enforcement and closed earlier this year after allegations of abuse. We'll get an update on what kind of abuse went on at that school and also talk about some action that case is spurring in the Iowa legislature. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes. Back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The rest of this hour, we want to provide an update on a disturbing story of alleged abuse that we talked about on this program back in February. Alleged abuse at a now closed boarding school in the southeastern Iowa town of Keokuk. It was called the Midwest Academy and offered its services to troubled teens. Earlier this year, it was raided by law enforcement. It was closed. And we're joined once again to talk about it with Lee Rude, investigative and Reader's Watchdog reporter at the Des Moines Register. Hello once again, Lee.
Hi there.
Remind us, many listeners no doubt hearing about this for the first time, what kind of boarding school was this? What youth found themselves attending it?
Well, so this was supposed to be a boarding school for troubled youth who were having problems maybe with, you know, drugs, delinquency, acting out at home or at school.
Mm-hmm. And so this was sold as a sort of a tough love approach to getting troubled youth back in line, parents who were distraught about their kids' behavior, I guess.
Yeah, and it was a private pay school. So it's sort of unlike other ones that may be used for kids in the foster care system, for example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did the allegations of abuse come to light, leading to this late January raid by law enforcement and the shutdown of the Midwest Academy?
From what we know, there was a student who alleged that she was sexually assaulted by the owner of the school, Ben Train. She told that to two staff members that we're aware of. And one of those staff members reported that to the state.
Mm-hmm. Now, earlier this month, a lawsuit was filed on behalf of six former students and several parents. Now, I want to have you tell us about this lawsuit in a moment, but earlier today, I spoke with one of the attorneys involved in this lawsuit. Let's listen to what he had to say, then have you comment further. Kurt Dial is an attorney for plaintiffs in this Midwest Academy case. He's working together with another attorney, David Verlager, and I began by asking Kurt Dial who he was representing in this civil lawsuit.
Yeah, there's two separate cases. One is Cheyenne Jarrett, who was an employee who filed a claim for wrongful termination, and then there's a separate case for a number of former students and parents of students who have filed a separate action.
Okay, give us an overview on each of the cases. Please start with the students. What is the lawsuit about there in that case?
Well, that lawsuit is just alleging that certain abuse took place. So there's a claim for numerous, I guess, civil remedies there, civil actions regarding the alleged abuse. And then there's a claim some of the parents are requesting that the money they paid be refunded.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us any details on the alleged abuse that took place?
Now, I mean, I'm not going to go into specific facts or specific alleged allegations at this point. I mean, it's still very early in the case. There's still a lot of discovery that's going to go on. So I'm not able to actually comment on any specific allegations.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I can put it this way. You've been a lawyer for some 40 years. How do these accounts stack up to previous cases like this of abuse? Is this on a scale some of the worst you've encountered?
Well, I guess, first of all, you don't really see a lot of cases regarding, you know, abuse at a boarding school or anything. And I guess if you look at other abuse cases, this is a lot different than you might see from standard abuse cases. I mean, most of the type of abuse cases you see are family matters. This is not that. So it's really hard to discern this from a lot of other cases because I don't think there's a lot of other cases like this around where you've dealt with an allegation of abuse or mistreatment at a school such as this.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the other case, the employee that you're representing, Cheyenne Jarrett. What is her case about?
Her case is the allegations in that case are that she was an employee of Midwest Academy, that she made a complaint of suspected child abuse, and then she was terminated as a result of making that complaint. So that's the allegation in her petition.
Mm-hmm. And if she hadn't been fired, would this have come to light sooner, you think?
Yeah, I don't know, because I believe that the allegation that she made is kind of what spurred the legal action of the, you know, all the law enforcement. So I don't know if she wouldn't have. I guess it's not the firing that brought the legal action. It was the complaint she made. The firing gives her a claim for the civil cause of action.
Why is this a civil lawsuit filed in district court?
It's a civil lawsuit because the allegations are private parties against each other. It's not law enforcement. There's no criminal action. So it's one private citizen bringing a claim against another private citizen or another private entity.
And what are you seeking in terms of damages?
The damages this time, there's unspecified. I know that the parents who paid money who have made claims are asking that their money be returned. Cheyenne's case could be looking at her lost wages that she's incurred and will incur in the future. And then the other students who were there would be looking at numerous claims for emotional distress. And so it'd be hard to put there's no specific amount that we could put at this time on the amount of damages requested.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that comes up also a lot of times through discovery.
You've told us you cannot specify the type of psychological and sexual abuse that happened at this place, is alleged to have happened. Can you tell us in your from your perspective as an attorney, is there evidence to support the allegations here? Plenty of evidence?
Well, I mean, there's obviously we'd have to have some evidence to file the lawsuit. So
how strong
of evidence?
Right. How strong is your case? I guess I'm asking.
I couldn't answer that at this point. I mean, lots of times you file lawsuits, things change as you start taking discovery. I know that there are a number of people we've talked to that have given consistent statements. So, you know, we feel it's a good case, but, you know, with any case, that's up for a jury ultimately to make that determination.
Mm-hmm. How many people, can you guess, do you know at this point will give a deposition?
You know, I don't know. From the numbers we have, I suspect it's going to be over 50.
Okay.
That includes some former students, some current, or some that were there, some employees, so.
All right. Kurt Dial, attorney for plaintiffs in the Midwest Academy case. Thank you for telling us what you can at this early stage in the civil lawsuit.
Yeah, thank you.
I recorded earlier this morning. Lee Rude, now with me live again, investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register. Listening to that, of course, a whole bunch of questions that Kurt Dial wasn't able to share with us. What else can you tell us, add about these cases? I guess first and foremost, difficult to hear, but give us some examples, Lee, of what you know about the type of abuse that is alleged to have gone on at this boarding school.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things about the lawsuit is that it shows that the FBI and the state was involved at Midwest Academy a year ago, last spring, when there were allegations of sexual abuse, because Ben Train, the owner, was found responsible by the Iowa Department of Human Services for that abuse. He's since appealed that, but they were there. They were investigating as far back as a year ago.
This was in early 2015.
Yeah, yeah. So we know that from the lawsuit. And then there are pretty widespread allegations from these six students and their parents. Fraud, negligent misrepresentation, false imprisonment, battery, assault, negligence, all sorts of things. Probably the most concerning, though, is, you know, the sex involving students that wasn't addressed. There was an allegation that a female staff member had sex with one of the students. So it'll be interesting to see how all of that unfolds.
Mm-hmm. Back to the point you pointed out is very interesting. The FBI involved in this in the spring of 2015, but the school not shut down until this raid in January of this year.
Correct.
So what do you see there?
Well, I mean, I think there are some unanswered questions. The state has always, you know, maintained to us that it had really no authority to regulate Midwest Academy because it was a private school. But, you know, here we see that there's, you know, evidence of sex abuse, some pretty serious allegations, and why the school wasn't shut down or why the FBI didn't take action then, nobody has really explained.
Mm-hmm. The other attorney we didn't talk to in this, David Verlager, is quoted as saying, perhaps in one of your articles, that it seems that they were treated as like something from a couple centuries ago, something out of Oliver Twist, with being deprived of enough food, also being isolated.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you talk to parents and some of the kids who went to Midwest Academies, their stories change from place to place. But the use of these isolation rooms where the kids were sometimes disciplined for very minor things are very concerning. You know, for example, there was a case where 11 boys ran away in one day. And the allegation is that they were put in these isolation rooms for several weeks at a time. Most of those kids who ran away were rounded up within one day.
Mm-hmm. And we would assume some of these kids would get back to their parents and say, here's what's going on. This isn't right. Or did that not happen? Weren't they able to communicate?
No, they weren't. In the early days, because the school kind of disciplined the kids or stepped them up as their conduct improved. A lot of these kids and their parents tell me that they had no way of communicating and that letters home that were critical of the school were censored or weren't sent.
Mm. So talk more about the Midwest Academy owner, Benjamin Train. What is he facing at this point?
We don't know. I mean, there have been no criminal allegations to this point. You know, I've been checking on that weekly, but nothing so far. Authorities have said that, you know, they have to go through boxes and boxes of evidence. But the early allegations were, you know, that he sexually abused a student. There was fraud involved at the home, allegations of child porn. So, you know, I guess we really won't know until authorities finish up their work.
And Ben Train or his attorney, they've not made any comment.
No, he has not commented.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there others implicated here as you look at the big picture here, possibly in addition to Ben Train, the owner of Midwest Academy?
Well, nobody else has been named that I'm aware of. You know, the Register tried in court to get more of the search warrant documents released. But at this time, authorities have chosen not to do that, and a judge has said they should be made public eventually, but they don't have to be made public immediately.
Mm-hmm. Lee, the attorney that we talked to, Kurt Dial, kept talking about how unique this case is. I wonder, from your perspective, what makes this case unique?
What makes it unique is that, a number of things. The number of kids involved, I mean, we've heard different reports of how many kids went there, but around 100 at any given time. The kids are very consistent. When they talk about the isolation and seclusion, the sex abuse among students that went unaddressed is, you know, very concerning. And the fact that the state has sort of, you know, thrown up its hands and said, you know, we really had no authority here. That's also troubling because we know that they were there.
Mm-hmm. What are the burning questions in your mind at this point?
Why didn't somebody do something at least a year ago? And you know, also we knew that things were going on even before that. There were 19 founded abuse complaints at the school when the raids happened. 28 more assessments happened over the course of that 2-day raid in January. So, you know, a big question that I have is you know, why didn't this happen sooner?
Mm-hmm. Has this spurred people to look at other such private boarding schools in Iowa, in the Midwest?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we did at the Register afterward is, you know, we talked to these parents and they would say we were desperate. We had no place to go. There aren't enough places to take kids when they're acting out like this, when they can't stay at home anymore. But there are places around the country that are licensed and have a lot of oversight. They have real therapy available for kids when they need it, professionally trained, you know, staff members, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's going to be an issue going forward as well.
Lee Root is with us of the Des Moines Register for the next few minutes. Also joining us right now, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Hello, Joyce.
Hi, Ben.
You've been listening in on this. We wanted to add you to this conversation because this case has inspired some action at the State House. What's been going on?
Well, the oversight committees in both the House and Senate are working on legislation to have more oversight over state agencies. When it comes to regulating institutions like this, especially the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services, I sat in on a House subcommittee meeting on this where they grilled folks from the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services about just why they couldn't intervene. They made pretty clear that the way the laws are written, they didn't have the authority to intervene. Although I think it's important to point out that the Department of Human Services did say that they did investigate child abuse allegations there, but that they are not free to discuss those. Those are confidential cases, and that whether or not they found child abuse there, they did not have the authority to shut the place down.
Mm-hmm. So there are bills that are still being discussed, that are still alive this session?
Yeah, there's the Senate Oversight Committee and the House Oversight Committee both have legislation that they're working on. There was a bit of a dust-up between the chair of the Senate committee, Senator Rob Hoag, and the chair of the House committee, Representative Bobby Kaufman, who's the son of the chairman of the Iowa Republican Party, kind of going after each other on who's doing the better job or who's trying to upstage who on this. But there is legislation out there now to give more oversight to the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services. They would create a new category of children's residential facilities, and they would have to describe their education program to the Department of Education. The House has taken that bill, and they've made a couple of changes. They're exempting churches, for example. So if a church took in low-income families or low-income children or troubled children, they would be exempt from any educational requirements. And the House also kind of puts more teeth into the bill that would go after any institution like this that falsely advertised themselves. The allegation is that Midwest Academy advertised that they were an accredited school, and they weren't.
Mm. Lee Rood, when you hear about how this has impacted the lawmakers, what are your questions when you look at how our lawmakers are perhaps ready to change some laws?
Yeah, I mean, well, one question, you know, I have is this sort of new category, is certification with the state enough? You know, I think there's room for debate there. But I think everybody agrees that we need something. Some sort of oversight. Mm-hmm. Some would require much more involvement by the state.
Do we know? I mean, what are other states doing, for instance? Do you know, Lee? How did we get? It appears we have this. Something fell through the cracks here.
Yeah, something did fall through the cracks. I mean, Iowa. I think in some states it's mandatory that they would be, even a private school would be have some sort of state oversight. And I think the school located here, at least I've been told that, because there was very little oversight by the state. So, I mean, that's something for lawmakers to look at.
Mm-hmm. Joyce, anything else to mention from the State House there on this issue?
Well, they do seem to be on track to pass something. I think it's gotten enough publicity that, you know, there is an interest in passing something. And it's exempt from any funnels because it's in these oversight committees.
Mm-hmm. Lee Rood, any other relevant aspects in this case you'd like to mention before we go? We've got a couple minutes left here that we haven't.
No, we're just continuing to talk to families and to students who went there, and there will be more stories coming. I'm looking into some sort of broader angle things that you'll be seeing in the next couple of weeks. So, you know, and I wish I could provide some sort of timeline for when the criminal probe will wrap up, but they did say it was going to take quite some time.
Mm-hmm. Just tell us a little bit about how you work as an investigative reporter. What are your days taken up with when you look at a case like this and try to uncover new details?
Well, you know, I am always working on several stories at once, but I'm sort of methodical about trying to follow up and talk to the people who contact me and follow different questions and leads. I kind of make a long laundry list and tick things off as we kind of get the answers to something, you know. So there's still a lot of questions out there, you know. So it's a week at a time.
Right. And we're hearing this and people horrified and hearing the story here, too. I don't know. Do you need that distance, I suppose, to cover this and details like this of abuse? It's tough to do, I bet.
Yeah, it can be. Especially when, you know, you talk to some of these kids, it's strange because some parents are so, and students, which is so loyal to that school.
Still,
very much so. There's a long list of families that the school used as references who are very proud of the school and how it involved families and how it straightened out kids in times of crisis, even if the kids still struggle today. But then there are those who say that their kid was, you know, fragile, kids with autism, kids with mental health issues that weren't even acknowledged, and to be put in an isolation when, you know, without really understanding why, you know, it was torturous for some kids.
Mm. Okay. Lee Rood, investigative and reader's watchdog reporter at the Des Moines Register. Thank you for your time. I have a feeling we'll be checking back in with you for further updates on this program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent, thank you for the angle from our Capitol.
Okay, Ben.
I want to remind you as we head out here that tomorrow it's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We'll be remembering the two Des Moines police officers who died last Saturday in a collision on I-80. We'll find out a little bit about how these, they just had graduated from the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy. We'll learn a little bit about them after their tragic deaths, and plenty more on our News Buzz edition of River to River. A reminder that it's our spring pledge drive. You can help us succeed meeting our goal of $325,000. We're closing in on $100,000 in pledges right now. Perhaps you can push us over into the triple digits. Give us a call, 800-235-2665, or go online, iowapublicradio.org. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Boone. I'm Ben Kiefer.